Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable. Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to episode 126 of the Last Round Podcast. Thank you for joining us, whether you're listening on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Boxing Socials, YouTube, our new app that we just jumped into in the country of India, JioSaavn. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. We haven't got any hate mail about me mispronouncing it, so I'm assuming it's right. Wherever you're at, however you're listening, we definitely appreciate it. This week, coming off a big weekend in the, I guess I could call it sports and entertainment. We'll definitely jump into to that whole situation with the whole Triller Fight Club and what kind of event that was this past Saturday. But this week, helping us review this past weekend's fights and sports and entertainment events, if you will, he's a member of the Boxing Writers Association of America, a member of the International Boxing Research Organization. He's a writer, voice actor. He also runs the boxing Twitter account called Boxing History. You may have seen some of his work in the past on Bad Left Hook, The Guardian, Boxing Scene, Boxing Monthly, The Fight City. He's been all over the place. Boxing fans definitely know who he is. I'm sure you've seen a lot of his tweets over the years, especially the Boxing History tweets, because there's a lot of people who probably don't even know that you run that account, but you do. Patrick Connor joins us this week on the Last Round. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, gentlemen, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Definitely. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us here. Kind of jumping right into it, before, obviously, everybody wants us to talk about the Triller event, since that one was getting the most traction the last couple of days. But we're going to start with this past Saturday, the 17th of April, from the Seminole Hard Rock and Casino in Florida on DAZN. Demetrius Andrade retains his middleweight crown with the 12-round unanimous decision win over Liam Williams. Patrick, just right off the bat, what'd you think about this matchup, and where does Andrade go from here?
I think Demetrius Andrade, he is badly in need of, in my opinion, a really strong showing. And by really strong showing, I mean more than just a dominating decision win or kind of like a late overwhelming stoppage, but like he needs to blow somebody out of the water, in my opinion. And that's not necessarily to say that he doesn't deserve a shot at one of the bigger middleweight champions or one of the bigger named fighters in the realm of middleweight or super middleweight even, but it's really difficult to argue on his behalf that he deserves one of these big fights when he keeps turning in these performances that are mostly forgettable. I don't personally have anything against Demetrius Andrade. I think he's a good fighter for sure. There's no question. He's very talented, but as they say, fighters need to kind of go into a different gear much of the time great fighters need to find a different gear when it's necessary. And he seems mostly content to kind of just cruise, and that works against him.
What did you think about this matchup before, obviously, they fought and Andrade got the win? Did you think Williams was going to be able to give him some type of fight?
I thought that Williams might be able to push him, and he did in spots. But in my opinion, Liam Williams is also kind of on the level where he's not quite world-class. He's not that far from it, but he's not quite world-class. And so in my opinion, he's the kind of guy that a true world-class fighter is probably going to demonstrate that they're on a different level. And, that's kind of what I mean, is that Demetrius Andrade seemed to be on a different level than Liam Williams, but in spots, it almost seemed like he was content to not really go to a different level, you know, like I said, content to cruise. And so anyway, to answer your question more succinctly, no, I thought that Demetrius Andrade was going to win and that, again, he should have shown a bit more fire, a bit more urgency to put on a good show.
you mentioned that he needs, you know, a big opponent with a high profile, like, you know, like obviously like a Canelo, everybody wants a Canelo, or even a Triple G at 160 pounds. He needs somebody across the ring from him to be able to show what his skills are, to really make some type of statement. But obviously boxing fans know that he's been having trouble getting these guys in the ring. There's been criticisms, not of his talent, but just kind of maybe his profile, that he doesn't have the profile to really kind of get a fight with these guys. Cause I mean, obviously what you, typically, I'm sure everybody, you know, this Mike knows this, there's always an A and B side, but typically the A side, when they're fighting, their opponent, that opponent also helps the bottom line of the financials, in some way, shape or form. And the criticism with Andrade, is that he doesn't really move the needle too much from the financial standpoint. What's your take on that, and how does he get out of that, you know, general hole?
Well, I think that putting on a really explosive performance would be probably the best way to do that, generally speaking. But with Andrade, I think it's a mixture of bad luck and the timing, where you have a situation where Golovkin was, well, everybody's chasing Canelo. Everybody wants Canelo for obvious reasons. It's the money fight. And Golovkin, for a few years, seemed to have the best argument to get that fight. And then he finally got that fight and wound up kind of chasing that fight. He's still chasing a rubber match or a third fight. And rightfully so, even if he had lost both fights by knockout, he'd still be chasing a third fight just because of the money it brings. But you have this gravitational force in Canelo. Everybody's got their eyes turned toward him. And so there's really no incentive for all of these other fighters to fight each other unless they really have to. And everybody's holding out for this shot at Canelo. We had a very similar situation the last few years of Floyd Mayweather's career when he was active, where you had actually a pretty good set of welterweights, and very few were fighting each other because they were all holding out for that shot at Floyd Mayweather. And so that it's definitely a catch-22, where if you're sitting there waiting for the shot and you don't want to lose the shot because you don't want to lose a fight, you're in the meanwhile just kind of letting time go by, ripening on the vine, as they say. And you're also not building your ledger. You're not building your legacy. And so the remark I made the other day was that for some reason, I thought that Demetrius Andrade had turned pro in like 2012 or something. And when I looked, I was like, holy shit, he's been pro since 2008? Oh my God. Like it's not that he hasn't accomplished anything, but he really doesn't have a signature win. He doesn't have a really high profile win. And looking back, whenever it is that he retires, if he still doesn't have that signature win, those are the kinds of things that matter.
Mike, what'd you think about the matchup?
I mean, beforehand, I thought everyone kind of said that. I think it was either going to be Liam Williams by stoppage, or it was going to be the usual Andrade, just a unanimous decision. Early on, I think it was the second round when he managed to drop him. I thought we might actually see that performance, you know, at last. I thought, you know, Williams has got under his skin. Andrade's got a little bit of spite behind him. He had that kind of uppercut, was there all day. You know, he it was like a heat-seeking missile. You know, like Williams just couldn't work it out. He was just hitting the spot all the time, and I thought that was going to be the money shot, and I thought Andrade was going to jump on him and give us finally the performance we've been looking for. But I think after like rounds three or four, he did, just as Patrick said, he kind of just, you know, goes into third gear. He's like, you know, this is enough to kind of cruise by. I'm not going to get injured. I'm going to win a unanimous decision. And he's just happy to, you know, kind of cruise and pick up the paycheck. I don't know the problem. I think one of the problems we have is I think Andrade's probably earning good money fighting these B-level fighters. And sometimes you got to think to yourself, do I really want to risk my O for a little bit more money when I can fight these mediocre guys for a decent size? Could look at the checks that, you know, that Jesse Vargas was picking up when he signed for DAZN, getting $1 million to fight, you know, C-level fighters down in Mexico. So that's just, you know, boxing is sometimes its worst enemy.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up that point, Mike. And Patrick, you tell me what you think about this. You know, how Andrade might have the mentality right now where he's like, well, I'm making this type of money fighting these B and C level guys. You know, why should I fight the Canelos or the Triple G's or the Chamorro Charlos? I really don't think he actually thinks that way. I really believe that he wants these fights, but his team and Eddie Hearn, they just have, they're having a tough time getting these guys to the negotiating table. I mean, am I wrong, Patrick? What do you think on that?
Yeah, I think that, like I said earlier, it's a mixture of timing, bad luck and timing as far as when Andre came along and whatnot, and that you have Golovkin and Canelo. And I mean, Canelo kind of just has his pick as far as who he can face for the most part. And so that being the case, you'd really only face a guy like Andre if you had to, or if you were backed into a corner, or if he brought money. And that's the thing, is that does he really bring money to the negotiating table? And it doesn't seem like he does, because it just seems like he's making money off of his contract, which is good for him. For the most part, the objective of just about any fighter should be to get paid as much as you possibly can and take as little punishment as you can in the process. And to that end, I guess Demetrius Andrade has done pretty well. He's done a good job, and he's gotten paid very well for some overall relatively easy fights. So, yeah, there might not be that much incentive in terms of hunger, in terms of needing money because he's not making money or something like that. It seems as though the opportunity is there for him to be content where he is, I should say. He says the right things. He says that he wants these big fights and that he wants this, that, and the other thing. But like I kind of opened up saying, he needs an explosive performance, because he opened up, like you said, Mike, early in this fight, it seemed as though we were going to get it. It seemed as though it was right there. And that was almost like worse than not doing that at all, because we saw it. We saw what you could do. We saw that you could have done that. And then you just took your foot off the gas. And that's the constant criticism of Demetrius Andrade thus far, and it continues to be. I don't really envy Eddie Hearn in terms of having to promote him and having to look him in the eye or on Zoom or call him up and say, yeah, man, we signed you to this contract specifically because we had Canelo and Golovkin signed, and we probably pitched to you that you were going to be fighting one or both of these guys at some point. And here we are 2-3 years on, and what's going on? I don't know. I guess we'll just keep throwing money at you to fight Liam Williams or this dude. Yeah, I don't envy that position. But at the same time, I guess Demetrius Andrade's doing all right. I guess if the worst thing we could say is he didn't really have a signature win, but he ends his career with a fair bit of money and not all messed up, then that's not too bad.
What do you think going forward for Andrade is the most likely, I guess, quote unquote marquee name at middleweight that he could eventually get in the ring with?
Oh man. I mean, it sure sounds like lately Canelo has been more open to a third fight with Golovkin than he had been in the past. And I mean, it kind of sucks to have to speak about it in terms like that. Like, you know, what's Canelo doing? Because that's going to dictate everything else. But that kind of is the case. And considering that Canelo's with DAZN, or at least I think, because that situation is somewhat complicated. For the time being, it sounds like he's with Matchroom and everything's hunky-dory. But, man, I really don't know, because the promotional complications narrow the field as far as possible opponents. And I would have to say that it sounds as, I know that Eddie Hearn's been saying the Charlo's name, Charlo brother's name, both of their names a little bit more lately. And it sounds like they could be open to working something out. And while that probably wouldn't be a very pretty matchup, it would be exactly what Demetrius Andrade needs in terms of a name, and I'd take that.
Barring any, you know, any, I guess, exceptions in Andre's contract with Matchroom and DAZN, do you think that it'd be more likely that Andre goes to a Showtime or a Fox platform to fight a Charlo, or does Charlo go to DAZN?
Even just in terms of the production, I would hope they would go to Showtime or Fox or something. I'm not a fan of the DAZN production, and I think that those other platforms would just do a better job of handling something like that personally. But I mean, whatever, I guess, offers the most money and whatever gets the fight done, I don't really have that much of a preference. What I think would happen is, yeah, I think that it sounds as though a lot of the fighters with Premier Boxing Champions are very loyal to Premier Boxing Champions. And if they are able to kind of be loaned out, as it were, they're going to need to get Al's blessing. And it's probably just easier to do stuff on the Showtime platform or the CBS platform.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. He's definitely, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better in terms of going forward for him to try to get these bigger fights with these marquee names. Mike, what do you got?
I was just going to say, you know, if Patrick just said that about DAZN, I can't wait till we review Triller.
Oh, gosh. We're getting there. We are definitely getting there.
I won't put in punches, as they say.
Rounding off that DAZN card, Carlos Gongora got the 8th round KO over Christopher Pearson. This was for the IBO super middleweight title. Patrick, what's your take on I know we have the people call them the quote-unquote alphabet titles at WBC, WBO, but the IBO still goes forward, and they're still trying to find their place. They're still trying to be recognized. We had Ed Levine on the show a couple months back, or sometime, maybe 6 months back. He's a great guy. He talks about the digital rankings they have, the computerized rankings, and how, you know, he feels that every sanctioning body should be like that. I mean, what's your take on the IBO and how they're trying to find their place in the sport?
I think that kind of much like Box Rec's ranking system, they aim to take a lot of the human element out of the rankings. And by that, I mean, they generally like plug in criteria into a computer and assign different kinds of wins, a point system and stuff like that. And then based on that point system, that's how people get ranked. And so I think that there's something to that. I think that there's something a little bit more objective to that than having to rely on, like, most of these sanctioning organizations have, like, rankings committees and things like that. And as we know, people can get bought. People can be swayed, influenced, and even if they're not outright bribed, what often happens is these sanctioning organizations, the WBC, for instance, winds up having these super swanky ass Cancun, you know, banquets and whatever once a year. And they're like, well, we're a nonprofit organization. We're not in for the money. I don't know. Somebody's paying for that. I don't know who's paying for it. And nobody really seems to just be independently wealthy in the situation, but whatever. Point being, with IBO and with BoxRec, it seems to kind of take a little bit of that element out of the ranking situation. The problem is that you also wind up with some really absurd ass rankings sometimes that like make zero sense just because of some technicality with this point system you're using. So generally speaking, I think the fewer belts you have, the better, just as a general rule. If there were a way for these organizations to kind of get together more often and rank each other's champions or something like that, so that it's not so difficult for them to unify, it wouldn't be as big a problem. But we already know that's not the case. And so, needless to say, there should be one champion per division. And so entering a whole bunch of new belts and organizations into the equation is just usually not a good idea.
One belt to rule them all.
Yeah. to bind them to the sanctioning fees. Right. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So Patrick, so would you be in favor of like a Dana White UFC model then, since that's been a topic in the past?
Well, I hate to sit on the fence, but there are advantages to that system. We do see in the UFC specifically, it's not across the board, because it's the UFC model, and Dana White seems to be kind of phasing himself out a little bit in recent like months, he's kind of, he at least appears to be taking a less active role in what the and what's going on with the UFC, but he still can at just about any time step in and say, screw this, you know, you're not getting your shot. So that's not very fun or fair or cool. But generally speaking, what happens is if a fighter deserves that shot, they get it. Even if it's just on the strength of fans whining about it, they sometimes respond to that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that's more than what can be said for a number of big matchups in boxing. How many months now? How many times has Eddie Hearn said that Joshua Fury's done? How many times has he announced it? And we're like, okay, well, they're preparing to maybe do some stuff. We don't know. And the same thing for Crawford and Spence. So there are advantages of that kind of system where it's like you have an emperor ruling the whole thing and everybody's under one banner. And that's what a lot of people assumed would happen with Premier Boxing Champions. Obviously, that's in boxing, it would be nearly impossible. There are too many competing interests. It's still a little bit too much of a kind of free market as far as sports goes, compared to other sports anyway, for that to really happen. But there are good things that could come with that arrangement. There are also, as we know from the UFC, a lot of really bad things where a number of these fighters are trying to band together and unionize because they feel like they're getting shafted so badly. So, you know, there needs to be a better system than what we have in boxing, but I'm not really convinced that UFC like model is what we need.
Right. What do you think, Mike?
No, I kind of agree. There are some good things, you know, like you said, they kind of give you the fights that you want, but then there are also times that, like, Leon Edwards, for people that listen, like, he's kind of been like the number one contender in that weight division for a while, but he doesn't really sell. He's British, where if you're Conor McGregor and you sell and you've done, I think he's 8 of the top 10 pay-per-views in the UFC are all Conor McGregor. He just picks and chooses when he wants, who he fights, you know, because technically it's a business. And then obviously, you know, back to the paydays for some of the UFC fighters, you know, some of them are earning pennies to get kicked in the head. So, you know, it's not always great where you can see, you know, the UFC are rolling in money. You know, you have the PI over in Vegas and stuff like that. So, you know, they're making money hand over fist where some of the guys are, you know, top 10 in their weight category in the world. And the, you know, servers at Buffalo Wild Wings. It's insane.
Yeah. And then, Patrick, you touched on Joshua Fury that, you know, obviously Eddie Hearn's been back and forth saying, oh, it's signed, or yeah, there's an agreement in place. And that, you know, really quick, you know, I think that the most recent news was that I saw a report, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but that this might land in Saudi Arabia. Which a lot of people kind of were expecting in a sense, especially since, you know, the pandemic, it seems like we came out of this pandemic, but it's still not 100%, you know, we're still going in a good direction, but nobody knows for sure going forward yet. Do you think it's going to end up being in the Middle East somewhere, Patrick? And if it's not the Middle East, where would it be?
Well, it sounds as though between Matchroom and MTK, there are a number of different entities that are kind of setting up shop in the Middle East, like, you know, Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, or in Saudi Arabia. It sounds like, I don't know the arrangement. I remember kind of reading briefly about it, but I know that Eddie Hearn has got some sort of business arrangement going on with, like, the Saudi. I don't know if it's like directly with the Royals. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to like charge some weird stuff here, but it sounds like there's some sort of arrangement going on where it's beneficial to both parties to have some fight cards in either Jeddah or somewhere nearby. And when that started with the Joshua Ruiz rematch, I think a lot of people were like, whoa, what do you mean? Like, why are we going here? This is weird. The whole stage setup seemed kind of different. A lot of the setup seemed it was just different. A lot of people were unfamiliar with the customs, or at least what had to happen if you needed to go there to cover it, or why does it look this way, et cetera. But a lot of the answer from Eddie Hearn was like, well, we're just kind of trying it out. We're seeing how it goes. And several people seem to know better. Like, why are we going in this direction? And it sounds like there is a more long-term business arrangement than they were kind of letting on. And it sounds like this could become a slightly more regular thing. And it, what it comes down to, I guess, is probably just money, site fees. Whoever it is who's plunking down the money is outbidding other people. And that's probably pretty significant because places like O2, places like Wembley are going to be, those are the kinds of places that would be looking to host this. And those places can hold 75, 80,000, 90,000 people. So part of that is the pandemic. We're not 100% sure whether or not we're going to be able to pack 80,000, 90,000 people into a place for a fight like that, which would obviously sell out and be able to pack that many people. So if we're not that sure about it, we're going to have to kind of have something in our back pocket. It sounds like the something in our back pocket is Saudi Arabia site fees. That's what it sounds like to me.
Right. Yeah. Mike and I had this conversation in the past episodes. I remember when the WWE started going over there for their events. Mike and I had mentioned on a couple episodes when they went over there, I said, this is going to open the door for the UFC and boxing to go over there. Now that the countries over there, Dubai, Saudi Arabia and stuff like that, got somebody with, the gigantic, plethora that is WWE over there. I'm sure boxing promoters like Top Rank, who's been over there a few times now, like I'm sure they noticed it right away. Matchroom, of course. I think it's here to stay. There's going to be quite a few fights there. I mean, obviously the most recent one was the Carl Frampton and Jamel Herring, over there. The production value wasn't really that great, but, they went over there, like Patrick said, the site fee. They're able, and I think there's also reports that that part of the world wants to increase their tourism and show the Western countries that we want tourism, come travel to us and stuff. So I mean, what better than to get like an American product or an English product for that matter, and kind of promote it and use it to promote their country as well. So yeah, I think it's here to stay. I know it sucks for, especially for the people in the United States because of the time frame or the time, when fights happen. But yeah, if it means that we get some type of fight like a Joshua Fury, regardless, I'm all for it. I mean, what do you think, Mike?
No, I agree. I think we kind of all assumed the first one would go to Saudi Arabia for the site fee, get the biggest payday they can. And then, the rematch. I'm intrigued about the rematch because Tyson Fury obviously has that kind of feud with the British Board of Boxing. And he said, nope, I'm never getting licensed by them again. I'm never fighting in the UK again. My home is now Vegas. So I'm intrigued to see, because I think obviously a lot of people are just assuming that, the second fight will be, Wembley Stadium, 90,000 fans. So is Tyson going to stick to his guns and do that? Or is he, the second choice, maybe the Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas? So it'd be great to see like 50,000 drunk UK fans running down the strip. That'll be a sight to see.
Yeah, maybe we'll see though. It's definitely going to be an interesting couple weeks coming up for that Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua negotiations. Moving on to fight previews from the Shrine. Actually, no, one more review. I'm sorry about that. From the Shrine Exposition Center in downtown Los Angeles on Fox. Tony Harrison, former 154 world champion, and Bryant Pirella fight to a split draw after Pirella cut his left eye on an accidental headbutt. But just before you came on, Patrick, Mike and I were kind of touching on this fight, that Harrison, at least to us, didn't really show the level that he had maybe against Charlo. And I'm talking about even in the first, especially the first fight, but even the second fight. What do you think about Harrison's performance? Does he still kind of have that fire to kind of get another world title under his belt?
I feel bad for Tony Harrison, to be honest, because he's been through the ringer in the last couple of years, losing his dad. And it's been a tough journey for him, and also suffering the two stoppage losses, first to Jared Hurd and then to Jermell Charlo. It's tough, you know. I feel bad for him because he seems like a pretty nice guy, and he seems like somebody who's kind of primed for a bigger performance or big showing, kind of like that first Charlo fight. But it's also worth mentioning that he fought three or four times in 2018 and only once in 2019, didn't fight in 2020, and then here we are, you know, 4 months into 2021. And that's his first fight. And I think inactivity's definitely hurt him here. To answer your question, I thought that he definitely looked rusty, perhaps lacking fire. It was not his best performance. He didn't seem like he was, I don't want to say he wasn't motivated, because I don't know how motivated he was, but he just seemed like he was kind of walking through the fight and stifling a lot of his own work and stuff like that. He was just not dialed in. He wasn't getting the rhythm down. He wasn't getting the distance down, et cetera. And on top of that, I don't want to downplay Bryant Perrella. He actually turned in a much better performance than a lot of people were expecting too. So it wasn't just, Tony Harrison looked crappy. Bryant Perrella also stepped up and he outfought him in a number of those rounds. So he deserves a lot of that credit too. But it's tough to know where Tony Harrison's place is in the division when, you know, what is he, 30, 31? And that's not dreadfully old or something, but he's like has 30 fights. So the inactivity recently is going to, it definitely has hurt him. I think he needs to get back in the ring as soon as he can. And he needs to kind of up the activity, up the confidence.
You know, Harrison reminds me of James DeGale. He's like super talented, and then he just goes missing. He'll be winning the fight, and he's like, oh, I've got it in the bag. Just takes parts of rounds off. Then he starts, obviously, the momentum shifts, and then he starts thinking, oh, shit, I think I'm behind now. He's so annoying to watch, so frustrating, because he's super talented.
Yeah, you see flashes of it. You see that he's not, you see that he is very talented, and being from Detroit, you know, Detroit obviously has a great boxing history behind it. And, you know, you love that kind of story, especially with Tony Harrison and his losing his father last year. And it would be nice to kind of see him have a nice comeback. But I don't want to say that it's still in him, or at least it still seems like it's in him. But I'd like to see him get a little momentum.
Does he still, does PBC or for that matter, Al Haymon, does he still try to put Tony Harrison in some type of championship bout even after this split draw, or does he try to put him in another bout to kind of really get that solidified W before he tries to prepare him for maybe the winner of Charlo Castaño or anything like that?
That's a good question. My own speculation on how Premier Boxing Champions treats their fighters, or not so much treats their fighters, but ever since they came around, it almost seems as if they have this pocket of like the stable of fighters that they have at the ready. Like if somebody pulls out, if they need an opponent on such and such date, like they have the size stable where they can just grab somebody. And on top of that, in 154 pound division, from 147 to 154, they've had it mostly on lock in the last few years. So, if nothing else, I think that they would probably keep Tony Harrison around as that kind of guy. I almost feel as though it depends on like how loyal you are to Premier Boxing Champions and how good you're talking about him in the press. And I don't say that to badmouth them or to say that it's like a cult or something like that. It's that it's clear that these fighters are encouraged to be very enthusiastic about being with Premier Boxing Champions. Some fighters are outwardly more enthusiastic than others. A lot of those fighters who are outwardly enthusiastic seem to get a lot of the good opportunities. And perhaps that's kind of like a self-feeding thing. You know, of course you're going to be enthusiastic because you're getting the opportunities. And then since you're getting the opportunities, you're going to be, you know, et cetera. But long story short, I think that Tony Harrison will probably, they don't seem to axe too many fighters all that often. So they'll probably keep him around. And I don't want to talk like he's some, you know, toss around fighter or something like that. He's still very good. And it's not like he's ruined or anything. He's still got some, I think he still has some time, but it the landscape from 154 to 160 pounds is kind of, that's what needs to shake out. I don't know where he figures in.
What about a potential matchup, Patrick? Somebody who's said, you know, in interviews and on camera interviews, and so has his dad, that he's likely going to move to 154 is Danny Garcia, Danny Swift Garcia. That it's a little bit, you know, it's getting pretty difficult to make 147. Both him and his dad, as I mentioned, have said that they're probably going to move to 154. What do you think about a matchup between Garcia and Harrison in the future?
Well, I hope he doesn't consider cutting off that toe to make 140. I'm kidding. Don't do that.
I always forget about I always forget about his toe. That's true. I totally forget about it. He wears it like a badge of honor.
Yeah, totally throw off his balance. No, I think that Danny Garcia is another one of those fighters where he's almost kind of like John Ruiz from years back, where, and I don't, not in style really, but in that he's underrated because he's aggravating. A lot of people don't like him. A lot of people don't like Angel Garcia, and it's totally understandable. He's just kind of a goober, and his dad's kind of a jerk. So nobody really could be blamed for just not liking him for that reason alone. A number of his bigger matchups, though, he's fallen just short, or and even in some of the fights that he's won, he's seemed to fall short. And a number of people felt he lost those fights. Mauricio Herrera, a lot of people felt he lost that fight. You know, Peterson, et cetera, or maybe it was Zab Judah. Can't remember. A number of these fights, people were just kind of nonplussed or unimpressed with his performance. But even so, even if people were unimpressed or if he deserved to lose, he didn't deserve to lose big. And at worst, he's keeping it pretty even up with the best fighters in the world, more or less. So it's kind of it's a funky case, because you look at his ledger and it's like, you don't know where to put him. He's got a couple of really good wins, but a number of really close fights too. That being said, if he does move to 154 pounds, I'm not sure. His power didn't carry up with him to 147 pounds quite as much as
140.
You know, many people would have liked. Or, I mean, he was definitely a one-punch banger at 140. At 147, he could hurt you, but he wasn't putting you out. At 154... It's a pretty good leap from 147 to 154, and I think that would be pretty tough for him to do. But Tony Harrison's the kind of guy that if you are going to 154 pounds and you're planning on making a sincere title run, then you should be expected to get past Tony Harrison.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm definitely I was kind of disappointed to see, you know, Harrison and Pereira, like, you'll go fight to some type of draw because the accidental headbutt, because I'm sure Heyman had the plan to try to put Harrison back in that title picture. So we'll see where it goes from there. But and then Danny Garcia, obviously, you know, if he moves to 154, like you said, I had the same concerns. I don't think his power is definitely going to decrease as he goes up to from 147 to 154. But, you know, all of his losses that he has in his career, they're still close fights. So yeah. He finds a way to keep it interesting. So that he has that type of X factor, if you want to describe it like that. Moving on, also this past Saturday, the event that everybody's been talking about, from the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, Georgia, Triller Fight Club returns, headlined by Jake Paul, who gets the YouTuber Jake Paul gets the TKO, first round TKO over MMA fighter Ben Askren. Before we kind of dive in, obviously, we're going to talk about the matchups and stuff, especially the Regis Progre, Ivan Redcatch situation. What's your overall thoughts on Triller, on this event? Is it an entertainment with boxing? Is it an entertainment event with boxing matches, or is it a boxing match with entertainment?
I think it's the first one for the most part. I think what I had never heard of Triller before Mike Tyson, Roy Jones, or if I had, it was mostly like in passing. I didn't know anything about it. So when they announced that, I was like, okay, this sounds like they're putting a joke on some joke channel or app. Sounds good. Great. Fine. obviously that's not the case. There's a lot of money behind, you know, the people who are organizing all of this stuff. They have gotten the correct sponsors, or they've gotten the nobody's getting a booking fee for Justin Bieber. Like, just at, you know, nobody's just slapping down a checkbook and being like, get me Justin Bieber. Mm-hmm. You got to have a lot of money for somebody like that to show up. So, and that's not to speak down on any other musician who performed on the show, but to me, it's kind of like a variety show or variety hour where boxing just happens to be one of the things that they show. And beyond that, the people behind it basically used boxing as a vehicle for their product. That's kind of what it seems to me. It doesn't really seem to me like they're going to be heavy into boxing specifically per se. Maybe they are. But I think that it remains to be seen. I don't know that if they're going to be heavy into boxing per se, but it seems to me they're putting more money into the musical acts and the entertainment than boxing. And what I kind of need to see, in my opinion, is I need to see what they do with Teofimo Lopez versus George Cambosos. What are they going to do with that kind of card? Because clearly that kind of fight, even though George Cambosos is not a big name, Teofimo Lopez is coming off a big performance and a big win, still a big name in boxing news and whatnot. And so even if he's technically not headlining the card, because I don't know if they figured that out yet, he's still like the attraction, according to most boxing fans, on this card. So how are they going to handle that? Are they going to handle it as that being the attraction? Or is it going to kind of be another thing where this is just part of the show? I think that's kind of what I'm waiting to see, is a slightly bigger and more important fight in boxing. Regis Progre versus Ivan Redcash was significant, but not very big. And Lopez versus Cambosos is not super big, but bigger for sure. So I want to see what happens with that.
Patrick, I'm going to read one tweet that you tweeted following that event. You put, quote, "Much of the boxing world's response to Jake Paul, Askren, Triller, Snoop, and everything is a result of a misunderstanding of what boxing is, in my opinion. So many are quick to romanticize boxing and claim everyone who wears boxing gloves is a hero, a warrior. The thread continues, but just based off on that, can you kind of explain what you mean when you were thinking about that statement?
That's the kind of thing where I think that it kind of hits a weird tune for a lot of people when they hear that. A lot of boxing fans and pundits and writers and things like that, they hear something like that because they've heard for however long they've followed boxing, how harrowing it is and how, you know, oh my God, it's so visceral and it's so exciting. And that's not to say that it's not any of these things. It's just that you hear that so often that you forget that, like, these are people. They're just people. The vast majority of the boxing that we're watching and paying attention to is like 1% of the sport. And it's easy to forget that. Right now, there are like, I don't know exactly how many active fighters, but 10,000 or something like that. You know, let's just throw a name out there and say it's 10,000. Of those 10,000, we're following like 100 or something. We're following a very small percentage of fighters in the sport. The vast majority of fighters in the sport are nobodies, who are bricklayers, garbage men, women who work at the salon. I mean, whatever. They're just people. And are they any less heroic? Are they any less important than any of these other people who are pound for pound or anything? And it's like, you know, you start posing those kinds of questions and it gets uncomfortable because you've been told all of these things about how special fighters are. And newsflash, you know, fighters are also pieces of shit. Fighters are also awful people sometimes. Fighters are great people sometimes. It goes back and forth, obviously. So that's all I was trying to say, is that in the when you when we're talking about the Triller card and when we're talking about Jake Paul, the common refrain in that conversation is these people like Jake Paul and the YouTubes and all of these things are they're ruining boxing because boxing is a gentleman's sport and it's a something something. And it's like, well, you can't just say that and have that be true just because it's the situation you're arguing for. We already know, we joke all the time about how corrupt boxing is. We joke all the time about how ridiculous boxing is. So you can't talk about it as this fair gentleman's sport that nobody ever bends the rules, but then also in the next breath say, wow, man, it's populated by a bunch of pieces of shit. It can't really be both at the same time like that. So if you're saying, oh, you know, he's sullying the reputation of boxing, but boxing's perfectly capable of sullying its own reputation and has, first of all. But, you know, what makes Jake Paul's claim to these viewers less valid is my question. And that's kind of why I ended that thread with, then do better, boxing. Do better. I mean, I don't know why so many people feel threatened by the fact that he's like encroaching on the sport. And let me rephrase that. I understand why. I just feel it's hypocritical and it's absurd because just about any argument against this can be countered with that shit happens all the time in boxing, man. So it's a guy who's 2-0 or 3-0 fighting a dude who's never fought. Floyd Mayweather was 49-0 or whatever and fought a dude who's never fought. I mean, I know it's not the same thing, and I don't want to say it's exactly apples to apples, but my point is you can't complain about one and not the other, and et cetera, et cetera. So the hypocrisy that's inherent in all of this comes from a mistaken view that this is all just this big, like, you know, honorable spectacle, when in reality, I'm not trying to be a dick because I love boxing, but we're paying to watch two dudes or two women beat the shit out of each other. It's, and when you break it down like that, it's like, wow, how good are we? How cool are we for doing that? But that's true. I mean, and it's, and when you do break it down like that, it's kind of like, wow, why should this person be barred from that? I don't know. It just seems absurd to me as all. There's a lot of hypocrisy in the post-event arguments.
Mike?
No, I agree. I mean, I think people get confused that they think that there's like a set of boxing fans and he's stealing them. That's not the case. He's bringing his fans with him from the YouTube, you know, and he's created that pay-per-view platform, which he's taken advantage of, you know, and there's not one set like pot of money in boxing and he's taken a chunk of it that can't go to other fighters. That's not the case, which I think is where some people kind of get confused because, you know, you know, if they've come to watch him, they're already his fans. He's just taking kind of note of that pay-per-view platform. And if a small percentage of them get hooked and they start, you know, watching boxing and, you know, they want to box themselves, then, you know, that's a bonus. And at the end of the day, it's pay-per-view. If you don't want to pay for it, then don't.
Patrick, do you think it's fair to compare the pay-per-view performance of an event like this to actual boxing, pure boxing pay-per-views in terms of the performances, like I mentioned? Do you think it's fair to compare, or is it apples and oranges?
Well, it is kind of apples and oranges in the sense that it's not the same. And that kind of goes a little bit to what I was saying. It's what I was saying about the traditions of boxing and kind of how rigid it tends to be enters this conversation too, where, in my opinion, boxing could learn a lot of promotional and marketing kinds of things from what Triller is doing. Mike, what you're talking about with Jake Paul bringing his fans, this is something like this entire conversation that we're having right now, this is something that a lot of the people in boxing who have been around a long time, they're just going to skip right over. They don't give a shit. And not only do they not give a shit, it's that they think that, like, they can't even, it's newfangled, dude. They can't even get with this. They don't understand how somebody's going to sign up with an app, how is that boxing? You know what I mean? There are a lot of people who are ready to like exit this shit because they're like, oh my God, this is going to happen. Oh no, the rap is invading our stuff. We got to leave. You know, that it's that kind of almost like a situation where it's so rigid because it's been done this way for so long. And so somebody's deviating from that formula and they're like, whoa, they're cussing during the broadcast. Why are they cussing during the broadcast? Because people cuss. I mean, it's because you're keeping up this stiff corporate environment that a lot of these other sports have adopted, the NFL, the NBA, where you have to do things a certain way. Whereas in those sports, a lot of those people, they get taken care of with pensions and stuff like that. But in boxing, you're on your own, dude. So what's all this conformity and informality for anyway? It's a little bit absurd. And so when you get into, like I said, people not being able to understand this conversation, that YouTube is its own like world. When like I'm luckily right at the age or the cusp where I understand it. I'm luckily not that old yet. I get that there's an entire lifestyle here that a lot of younger kids are really into. To me, I don't have the time to watch hour, 2 hour long videos, like 3, 4, 5 times a week of just somebody looking at the camera. I don't have that time. Kids do, younger people do. And so they're into this stuff. This is a conversation that a lot of older people in boxing are like, whew, right over their head. They don't get it. And so Jake Paul's bringing his own fans, an entirely different demographic, an entirely different thing. This is not stealing fans from anybody. And in my opinion, if you're hearing about this event, watching it, whatever, and going, that's it, I'm done with boxing. How good a fan were you in the first place, man?
Right. No, right. Yeah, I agree. It's definitely an interesting time with Triller kind of jumping into the boxing world per se. You know, I guess, you know, like I mentioned earlier, Jake Paul's TKO first win TKO over Ben Askren. Even though some of our hardcore listeners might hate us talking about this matchup, what did you think about this matchup, Patrick?
To be honest, since I follow MMA enough, I don't follow it nearly as closely as I follow boxing, but I follow it enough to know that Ben Askren's a wrestler. He's a grappler. He's never been a striker. He's never a high-level striker, even in the UFC. And I don't mean to belittle striking in the UFC. It's just a different situation, different approach to striking. And the levels are like the judgment of the striking is different. A good punch in the UFC or in MMA is totally different from what a textbook or a good punch in boxing would be considered. That being said, the result should have been expected, really. A lot of people looked at it and they said, well, Ben Askren's a fighter. He's been fighting for X amount of years and Jake Paul's not. So therefore, Ben Askren should win. But I understand that. I'm not saying those people are dumb, but it's two different approaches. And on top of that, you have a guy in Jake Paul who has the funds to pay for good training, to pay for constant training, to get in very good shape, to basically get the best training money could buy. And Ben Askren wasn't really in that boat. He clearly did not show up in the same kind of shape. The result just really shouldn't have been that big a surprise. And obviously, it wasn't the same kind of fight in terms of the level of athletes, but just like Mayweather-McGregor shouldn't have been a surprise. It's two different sports. It's, you know, that's just how it is. And so there are going to be outliers and examples, and one that everybody always likes to bring up when the old boxing versus MMA debate is Ray Mercer once knocked out, what was it, former UFC champion Tim Sylvia, like whatever that was, like 2009 or something like that. Okay, that happened once. That's the one time it happened, you guys. There have been like, you know, 90 other examples where the boxer just got taken down and pounded out. Similarly, the MMA guy goes into a boxing ring, he gets his ears taken off. It's just how it goes. So, yeah, I understand also the backlash that you might get from your hardcore fans talking about it. But also, it was an event, you know, and a lot of people are talking about it, and it moves the needle.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I thought Jake Paul was going to win after you saw, you know, Ben Askren kind of shadow boxing and doing pads and stuff like that. You can see he was so slow, very rigid. The fact that he didn't really whip himself into shape. I think the fact that he just got offered a you know, his highest ever payday as well to pretty much just sell his name to the ledger.
That's a really good point.
You know, he's just one of those guys at the end of his career. He's like, you know, I'll just sell my name to Jake Paul's resume. And he goes home, you know, he's pretty much retired anyway. So it'd just be interesting to see kind of where he goes from this. Are we actually ever going to see him get in there, you know, with like a boxer? And I know there's talk of him fighting, you know, Tyson Fury's younger brother in Tommy Fury. But I can't really see that going ahead. You know, Tommy has a good fan base, but he also is a bit of a boxer. So I don't see Jake Paul actually, you know, risking it with him. But, you know, Patrick, I was going to ask, what did you think of the production and also Oscar De La Hoya's performance?
Oh, man. I think, like I said earlier, I think boxing has a lot of things that it could potentially learn from how they're putting together these thriller shows. I know a lot of people are very resistant to change in boxing, and the idea of putting on a musical performance, for instance, in the middle of a boxing show, even now, like, that's not that foreign. A number of promoters do stuff like that, and that's not that crazy. I've seen that before live a number of times. It doesn't bother me, but a lot of people are like, okay, get to the fights. What is this? It's a little ridiculous, like, to have that outlook, in my opinion. Like, it's just music, and would you rather just hear the house DJ play some awful stuff way too loud in your ear for 20 minutes between fights? No, the live musical performance is better. But a number of the things about the production are definitely more suited toward like a live concert show or something like that, rather than a typical or traditional boxing event. But a lot of things I liked. I liked the flashier entrances. That's something I've always liked. I've always liked that kind of wrestling style entrance. To me, that's fun. There's nothing bad about that, in my opinion, unless it's Arturo Gatti walking out and getting scared by his own pyrotechnics. Then that's bad. Or Deontay Wilder in his 45-pound suit. But, you know, there were a lot of things about the production that I liked and I thought were slick and were a good idea and were things that are definitely going to capture the audience that they're looking for. So they're smart with what they're doing in the production, in my opinion. Oscar, I feel bad for his family. I made a lot of jokes on Twitter and I'll stand by the jokes. I feel bad because he's clearly, like, speaking seriously. The dude's got a problem. And I hope he gets help. And it's not a good look, considering I don't know how involved he really is with Golden Boy Promotions. He might not be that involved at all. He might be more of kind of like a figurehead, but the impression is that he's involved. And when you have the dude who's representing your company going on to anywhere, sloppy drunk like that, it's not a good look. You know, it's just not a good look at all. And or drunk, whatever he was, inebriated. I don't know what was going on. But so I feel bad for him. But beyond the feeling bad, if you are going to go somewhere on live TV or a broadcast and you're that messed up, I mean, it's kind of like people reserve the right to make fun of you. That's just what it is. But as far as the stuff that he said, I don't know, man. The guy was off his rocker. He said a lot of foolish stuff about who he might fight in some maybe exhibition, maybe real fight. Nobody really knows because they keep delaying the announcement of whatever Oscar's getting himself into. And then, you know, I think I saw earlier today that there was a photo. Oscar De La Hoya was all messed up on Saturday night, but today he's training. And I'm like, So anyway, yeah, it was a fun show. Unfortunately for Oscar, that added to the fun. But, yeah. You know, I wish the guy the best.
What do you think, Patrick, in terms of Oscar De La Hoya now, you know, being on a couple of thriller platforms and now being on this event this past weekend? There's been insinuations or rumors, I guess, saying that he might have locked down some dates for his stable of fighters at Golden Boy on Triller going forward. I think people remember a couple of weeks ago when he had tweeted something in regards to DAZN saying they're not giving my guys dates. Ryan Garcia needs a fighter. DAZN needs to approve an opponent. You know, something. I'm kind of paraphrasing his tweet there, but I mean, does it seem like he knows that the DAZN relationship since losing Canelo is kind of gonna deteriorate? So he's going towards Triller now.
Well, from DAZN's standpoint, I guess if I were whoever is, you know, handling this at DAZN, I'd be looking at it as, why are we even dealing with Oscar De La Hoya at all? And their answer would be, because he brought Canelo to the table. Well, now Canelo is no longer at the table. So why are we dealing with this fool? That'd be the question. And so obviously there are still a number of fighters with Golden Boy Promotions who are, I don't want to just say, Canelo's not with Golden Boys. Who gives a crap? They're done. That's not the case. They actually have been fostering a number of young fighters over the years to their credit, and have built up a decent stable of younger fighters, mostly Latino fighters, but a number of fighters that are, you know, working their way into contention, if not into contention already. So the problem with Oscar, and this kind of unfortunately bleeds into his performance on Saturday night, is that he's prone to popping off on social media and saying some, you know, stuff that perhaps he shouldn't be saying in terms of business. And so you kind of are left to not really know whether he's serious or not about some of this stuff, or if he's just kind of inebriated and saying stuff he shouldn't be saying, like, for real. And I mean, I'm not trying to make a joke. That's serious. If you're going to be doing business and part of your business is kind of like negotiating through press, or at least it's seen that way, and you're getting messed up and popping off on social media, that's not good. And your investors ain't going to be happy. So, I don't know what kind of business he was doing at Triller. I do think that there's obviously a lot of money flying around over there. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him move some of his fighters over there, even if he's got to share some of the spotlight with, like, you know, Logan Paul or some random anime YouTuber or something.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's the thing that always comes to mind. I know he's having fun or whatever. Like, I mean, I know one of his good friends, Mario Lopez, on his podcast with Steve Kim this week, had said that he was he just had one too many cocktails. He was kind of defending him, which I understand. That's his friend, and he was just having a good time. But I always think about Mike, and I have talked about this on past episodes, that he's the face of Golden Boy. He is the Golden Boy, and he's still involved in the boxing world, trying to attract fighters to sign with him, trying to get fighters to stay with him long term. So and in that regard, like you touched on, Patrick, it does affect it, and you know, it doesn't seem like it going forward if he keeps doing stuff like that. Nobody says you can't have fun, but you know, you got to think about the PR standpoint of everything too when you're representing such a prominent company like his. But
you know, I agree 100%.
Right. And then moving on to, I guess, the real fight, even though there was kind of some type of acting going on in the conclusion of this fight, former 140-pound world champion Regis Progre, I guess the 26th win of his career, as he gets to the recently changed TKO, six-round TKO over Iron Redcatch. So Redcatch didn't, I guess, acted for, and you know, and I'm describing it pretty accurately, I believe, that he got hit below the belt, went out on a stretcher on his back, selling it, taking a term from professional wrestling. He sold it. What'd you think about that whole conclusion? And are you glad that it was changed to a TKO for Regis Progre?
Well, I mean, I guess it kind of reinforces what I was saying earlier about the kind of myth that every fighter who steps into the ring, regardless of whatever happens, is a true hero, warrior, something. Because, I mean, and that's not to say that there is no bravery. Every time somebody steps in the ring, there is bravery. That's tough, you know? I mean, last time I did it, I was a teenager, but even so, I remember it's nerve-wracking. It's terrifying. But even so, the guy clearly got hit with, like, Regis Progre's wrist on his hip, like, if that, it wasn't even really a very solid connection, and the dude went down like he was shot. So it's just kind of also supremely ironic that so many people are whining about Jake Paul and what he's doing to boxing when the real fight on the card ended like that. That is boxing. And so that's kind of the funny thing, is that there's no honor, man. You know, sometimes there is, but there's no like widespread across the board honor. There are going to be fighters who are going to be doing whatever they can do to get out of fights, and they don't want to fight. The dude gets hit on their hip with a thing and he's, I'm out of here. Come on, man. There's like 9 television cameras around. Everybody's going to see that. You're not getting away with it. So he wanted out. And on some level, I guess I kind of feel bad for him, because the dude is going to be taking a beating on social media for a while. But even so, like, he kind of deserves it, man. That's lame.
Mike, what'd you think?
I was kind of surprised, because I always thought Ivan Redcatch was a bit of a nutcase.
That's like, I thought he was going to tough through that. Like, yeah. He was going to be like, let's go.
It wasn't that long ago. Was it him and Javonte Davis? You know, Davis was posting some sparring videos, and you know, Redcatch was kind of taking a bit of a beating then, but, you know, he was taking some hard shots, you know, he was kind of carrying on. And, you know, I thought he was more kind of that way inclined, like, you know, too brave for his own good. I didn't think he was kind of, you know, he was losing the fight. You know, Pro Grey looked okay. You know, he was better than Redcatch, but it definitely wasn't, you know, Pro Grey in his, you know, one of his better performances. Interesting to see where Pro Grey goes from here. You know, 140, 147. I think he'd kind of be too small for 147, but yeah, you know, maybe he just needs to kind of knuckle down and diet a little bit better to go back down to 140. Interesting to see. You know, he's still only got that one loss to Josh Taylor, one of those fights where he actually came out looking good in that fight, kind of won a lot of fans over in Britain, so he still has that name. He still looks like he's chasing that Adrian Broner payday, fight that I would like to see. I don't know whether Broner would take it. I think he's kind of looking for as many soft touches as he can, some easy paydays from Uncle Espinoza. So interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I like Pro Grey, though. Pro Grey's been on the show before. We interviewed him at the StubHub Center following an event. So, you know, I'm a fan of the guy. I'm looking forward to see if he goes to welterweight or if he stays at 140, you know, because I think this fight, I think he weighed maybe 143, 144. It was somewhere like a catch weight of some sort. So
Broner, we'll see. Just whatever Broner walks in at, that's the way.
Yeah, the Broner rate. Yeah. Yeah. As we round off the show here, Patrick, you're going up into fight previews this upcoming Saturday, the 24th of April, from the Silver Spurs Arena in Kissimmee, Florida. Florida getting all the fights on ESPN. For the WBO featherweight world title, Emmanuel Navarrete, 32-1, goes up against Christopher Diaz, 26-2. What do you think about this matchup, Patrick?
Well, I think that it's, first of all, I've kind of been, I've had a little bit of a, with ESPN and their boxing schedule, it's kind of, it's really up and down. And I mean, I guess Bob Arum said it was going to be. And late in 2020, he said, all right, well, you guys, we're not really doing much until April because we gave you such a good end of the year in 2020, which admittedly they did. They closed the year very strong. So, I mean, it's good to see them opening up, or at least, you know, for the most part, opening up the warmer season. That's kind of when the fights really start to come about. It does kind of go into a little bit of a snooze for a few months, boxing. It's not a seasonable sport. It's 420, guys. What do you want me to do? They say it's not a seasonal sport, but it kind of is. It does shut down a little bit during the winter sometimes. So it's nice to see them opening up with a fairly strong fight on ESPN. I don't really know that much about Chris Diaz, to be honest, but I know that Emmanuel Navarrete is a really hard-hitting featherweight. He's a guy that you know, definitely need to be keeping your eye on. So, yeah, it's a fight I'm looking forward to.
Mike, what do you think?
Good fight. You know, Navarrete, since winning, you know, kind of burst on the scene December 2018. Since then, he's 7-0, 5 title defenses, all by stoppage. You know what I mean? He's obviously keeps himself busy. Christopher Diaz, I kind of like Christopher Diaz. You know, there's only two losses are against Marisuki Aito and also Shakur Stevenson. So, you know, better fighters in that weight division. So I think it'll be a good fight. I think Navarrete will be just too big, too strong. He's kind of got that Joe Joyce juggernaut thing about him because he's so big and powerful for that weight division. So he just walks people. Look at poor Isaac Dogbe. They looked like there was about five weight divisions between them when you saw them in the ring together. So he's good to watch, though. You know, he keeps himself active. You know, you got to make as much money as you can in that short period of time. So, you know, Navarrete kind of knows what he's doing. You don't get in there, don't fight, you don't get paid.
Right. And
Nick, it being in Florida, it should bring some of the fans out. Some of the Puerto Rican fans out, even though, you know, Florida doesn't have a massive Puerto Rican population, bigger than a lot of other places in the U.S. But I was going to say just that there's some unknowns there because there's some unknowns with Isaac Dogbo and where exactly he is in his career and what those wins exactly mean for Navarrete. And I kind of have the feeling that he might be a little bit of a front runner based on his size and stuff like that. So I want to see what happens if somebody's able to really battle back. I don't know if Chris Diaz is going to be the person to do that, but I hope he is.
Yeah, definitely. If he makes it interesting, it'll definitely make for good TV in terms of a boxing fight. You touched on Puerto Ricans, a lot of Puerto Ricans living in Florida, Patrick, rising contender. I would say rising prospect. And you guys tell me if you guys agree with that or not. Edgar Berlanga, 16-0, goes up against Demon Nicholson. What's your take on Berlanga?
Was another hard-hitting guy, for sure. There have been rumors, and I don't remember if there was video, because there's always seems to be kind of rumors and sparring and things like that. But I remember rumors of him kind of getting treated somewhat roughly in sparring a couple months ago by somebody. I don't remember who it was, but nonetheless, those are also sparring sessions and rumors. It doesn't really mean that much to me. However, when you have somebody like Edgar Berlanga, who's very hard hitting and hasn't really been pushed that hard, and is mostly just bowling people over, you just kind of have to be skeptical until you see them really get pushed back by somebody or hurt by somebody. And, you know, are they going to keep that power after somebody rocks them pretty good and their legs are gone? You know, those kinds of questions, those are relevant questions whenever you have a really big puncher. And there's also the question of where Edgar Berlanga is being pointed and career-wise. I don't think that he's like, I'd have to look, but I don't think he's okay. No, I look, he's 23. I thought he was older than that, but even so, I don't know where they're pointing him at in his career being a super middleweight. I would imagine that Canelo is probably on the menu or on the radar, hopefully for them, but we haven't seen anything from him apart from power, in my opinion. And it's going to take more than that to get to that level.
Do you think Berlanga, like you mentioned, apart from power, I think, is it all 16 wins or first round KOs or something like that? Do you think he feels that pressure going into to these fights now where he's like, okay, I need to get a knockout early or first round, second round to really kind of keep my, you know, I guess my mojo going? In a sense, because that's what people expect of me. Do you think being at that young age, do you think he feels that pressure?
He kind of seems as though he's feeling that pressure. The way that he talks and the way that he interviews, it sounds like he's very aware of his power. He's very aware that people feel that he's a powerful fighter. I guess it really depends, because some fighters are able to stave that off. Some fighters are able to ignore what people think. Some fighters are able to just say, I don't really care about the knockout. If it comes, it comes. And some fighters really do go gun for the knockout. It's really tough to say because he hasn't really faced anybody that good, you know, that high caliber. So I guess he could continue knocking people out. But the last person that I can remember like that would be, you know, Edwin Valero. I remember when he was in the midst of his knockout streak and people were going, oh, you know, he's got this knockout streak. And people were asking him the same questions. You know, what I guess he's a little different because he was, you know, a little weird, but nonetheless, you'd ask him, do you feel pressure? And he'd usually say, no, I don't really feel much pressure. I'm just trying to get the win. And most fighters give those kinds of answers, but he's obviously being billed as a power puncher and he seems aware of that.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And then Valera, that's another topic for another day, man. Valero's that guy for me in the last, you know, 15 to 20 years. I'm just like, oh, what could have been if his life didn't turn out the way it did? You know, what could have been with somebody like him? Rounding off this weekend from the York Hall and Mike's motherland in London on BT Sports for the Commonwealth and British middleweight title, Denzel Bentley, 14-0-1, goes up against Felix Cash, 13-0. Mike, since these are your specialties across the pond, I'll let you kind of preview this. What's this matchup?
Should be a good fight. You got a clash of styles. You got also, like kind of Patrick touched on, there's some sparring stories from back in the day where they did a few rounds together. They ended up rolling around on the floor because, you know, ended up going too hard. And then I believe they even ended up having a little fight in the street afterwards. So, you know, there's a little bit of heat there, which should make for a good matchup. You know, Denzel Bentley's bringing in the British middleweight title. Cash is bringing in the Commonwealth. So they've got one title each. Should be good, you know. Early for us in the over here in the US, it's probably about 11, 12 o'clock. And normally the Frank Warren shows are on ESPN Plus. So hopefully, you know, we can catch it.
Patrick, do you catch a lot of the fights across the pond in the UK?
When I can, yeah, I definitely do. And I enjoy the atmosphere. I enjoy the enthusiasm. It's definitely, there's more kind of permeation of boxing culture. And from my view in the UK than there is here, there's more like more fighters are household names in the UK than they are here, I should say. And I can appreciate that. I think that that's pretty cool that there's a lot of enthusiasm for boxing, not just at high levels, but also in the amateur level in the UK. And I was going to say, as far as this matchup, it's for the Commonwealth and the British middleweight title. There's a lot of history behind that title. You know, Dave McAteer, Dave Sands, and a lot of those, some of these guys are not British. They're Australian, of course, but for the Empire title, you know, Nigel Benn, Tony Simpson, a number of fighters who have held that title. So it's not an insignificant fight in that regard. There's a lot of history behind a lot of the Commonwealth and British titles. So they unfortunately get dismissed by a lot of American fans. But I generally speaking, boxing's in much better shape in the UK than it is in the US. So anyway, yes, I do try to catch as many British fights as I can possibly catch, and I'll be watching this one.
Patrick, I'm glad you kind of touched it, because I was going to ask the question then is, you know, the Commonwealth and, you know, especially the British title are looked on, you know, very highly over in the UK. You know, me and Danny kind of talked about it the other week. And what is your view on, you know, why is it you think that the US don't have kind of like a similar title that's held in, you know, such esteem?
Well, I think part of it is that it's so fractured. Every state or every territory over here, I think there might be one state that doesn't have an athletic commission, like Wyoming or something. But beyond that, every state has its own athletic commission. Many of them have different rules. Many of them have, you know, like different sets of regulations. Like for a quick example, and one that I bring up fairly regularly when I talk about Felix Trinidad on the boxing history accounts, and people say, oh, you know, if he's Cheeto Trinidad, he, you know, packed his gloves or he loaded his gloves. And I say, well, it's funny you say that, because what he was doing in his gloves is legal in Las Vegas, but not in New York, you know. But point being, there's different rules everywhere. And because of that, I think there's difficulty seeing eye to eye, or for all the commissions to come together to create like an American champion or something like that. You do have state championships, but they're pretty much meaningless at this point. Yeah. They don't mean anything. Whereas in recent or in other eras, you could reasonably expect an American champion, or the world champion for that matter, to face the British champion, because the British champion was considered good enough or important enough that it was like, okay, well, I guess you got to go knock that guy off and prove you're the best. Mm. And it's not so much the case anymore, because there's just not that kind of cooperation, I think.
It's funny because in the UK, you see guys, I think Tyson Fury actually did it. So he was like Southern area champion, English, yep. Irish, British, Commonwealth, European, and then, you know, so on and so forth, up, all the way up.
Yeah, and that's kind of a traditional or logical step, you know, especially if you're in the UK. Here, there's no real logical progression. But yeah, it's in the UK, there's far more, and that speaks to the culture. It speaks to boxing permeating the culture more, in my opinion, and also the tradition. The tradition's been kept alive a little bit better. But yeah, you know, you have fighters like Henry Cooper, who won Lonsdale title outright and defended it three times. And, you know, you get a whole new belt because of that or something. You know, it's a whole different tradition that a lot of American fight fans can't understand.
Right. Yeah. I ever since we started doing this podcast a couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago, I definitely say I can know a lot more about boxing in the UK because of Mike. You know, he definitely he has his finger on his pulse a lot more, and every week we talk about it. You know, we prep for each episode and stuff. So there's a lot of history over there. The British titles, the Commonwealth titles. So, you know, for our fans who are outside of the UK, we have a pretty big listener base in the UK, but for our fans in America and everywhere else, you know, we got to check out those fights in the UK because there's a lot of them that they go under the radar outside of the UK that are good clashes to catch. Also on that card, Callum Johnson, 18-1, goes up against Emil Markic. I hope I said that right. For the vacant WBO Global Light Heavyweight title. Mike, what do you think about this matchup?
Well, it's a big matchup, WBA Global. So I'm assuming that's higher than the world title, you know.
That's what I... Yeah,
you know, it's a good matchup.
It's a step below the galactic,
right? Exactly, right. You know, it's Callum Johnson's first fight with Frank Warren. Good run out for him to get back. You know, he's had a long time off. You know, since that performance against Beterbiev or Beterbiev, however you pronounce it. You know, if you remember rightly, you go back. You know, Callum actually dropped him. You know, ended up losing that fight, but one of those matchups where he actually came out, you know, actually looking better beforehand because, you know, there's not many people that get in there and, you know, perform well against Beterbiev. So a fight that he should win, trying to position himself. I think he's already spoke about, you know, trying to get a matchup with Joe Smith Jr. If and when he wins this fight. That's obviously why, you know, Frank Warren managed to get surprisingly, a WBO title, you know, on his card for a change.
Last week we touched about touched on the Joe Smith Jr. fight, there's one tweet that we had got where we were talking about Joe Smith Jr. and Artur Beterbiev being number one, number two at 175 pounds, and somebody tweeted, you know, what about Bivol? What do you think of, you know, where's Bivol belong in there? Who do you think is the number two, assuming Beterbiev is your number one, Patrick? Who's the number two at the light heavyweight division?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I think Joe Smith Jr. has a claim, if not the claim. The light heavyweight division is not super strong at the moment. And in the last handful of years, it kind of hasn't been. It's only been, you know, for small periods of time. But that being said, I would have to say that Joe Smith Jr. probably has the best momentum right now. Guys like Beterbiev and Bivol have been just a little bit too inactive, almost as if they're relying on their really extensive amateur career to kind of like carry their names through or something like that. Because neither of them have really accomplished a whole lot as professionals, which is really unfortunate because they both came into the professional ranks with really massive names. In the amateurs, I should say, because stateside, they're not huge stars or anything. But that being said, yeah, I think Joe Smith Jr. is also kind of like a fan favorite, kind of has the heart and minds of the fans, because he is who he is and how he is and the blue collar type of guy that he is. That doesn't really count toward resume per se, but he definitely seems to, that carries some weight with him. I mean, as far as this fight and Callum Johnson and stuff like that, I think Callum Johnson has obviously shown that he's above that kind of regional level, like the Frank Buglioni level, where Buglioni's a tough guy, a pretty decent fighter, But Callum Johnson's obviously on a different level than somebody like that, who's a little bit more kind of like UK regional. And the dude that Callum Johnson's taking on, Emil Markic, is, I don't know him. He's a guy from Bosnia Herzegovina that is seems to be frequently brought in from other European countries to kind of like help a UK dude get a showcase. So I don't know. I don't really expect a whole big performance from him. And I don't know where Callum Johnson fits in the whole light heavyweight picture. I don't really think that he belongs on that world-class level, but I would like to see, based on kind of what we saw last weekend too, I would like to see Joe Smith work his way in there, even just in terms of, seeing a guy like that get a good shot.
Packett, what's your opinion on Anthony Yard? He was supposed to be on this card, ended up with a tooth abscess. And obviously the rumors were that he was, well, not a rumor. I think he actually announced that he was going to leave Tundi Ajayi. And then he eventually just ended up staying with Tundi.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Anthony Yard's like a pretty young dude. He's like 21 or 22. He's obviously shown he's got a lot of potential, but he really needs to work on his stamina. He really needs to work on pacing himself. That seems to kind of be a consistent issue with him. I don't know what his thought process is as far as where he's going. I want to say in the last year or so, he's had a couple of personal things happen too, hasn't he?
Yeah. I believe, wasn't it his grandmother passed away due to COVID?
Yeah. I want to say he's lost a couple of family members.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things are obviously devastating and going to affect a career. But anyway, I don't know. I don't really know what to make of him quite yet. And especially in the wake of, losing a close decision, coming off losing a close decision, and then kind of like having a very good showing against Sergey Kovalev and then getting stopped in a war. It seems like he's gone through a lot in a very young career.
He has a lot of potential, though. He does, like you mentioned.
I always get the impression from him, and maybe it's just because of Tundi is so loud and kind of brash and in your face, that he's all about the showmanship over the actual substance of performance.
It does kind of seem that way. And I think that the way that he fights in spots kind of supports that in a way. He seems very muscle bound. His neck is really small and wide. He seems like he needs to try a different approach or something like that. And I don't know that if you're 22, 23 years old, you've been a pro for a few years, obviously been fighting for a long time, I don't know how much he's going to actually change things up. They've got a lot to look at.
Right. Before we cross the finish line on this week's episode of The Last Round, Patrick, you have a book coming out in August of 2021, a couple months away. It's called Shot at a Brothel, The Spectacular Demise of Oscar Ringo Bonavena. As I mentioned, scheduled to be released sometime in August 2021. Can you kind of give us a background on this book and what should boxing fans expect if they get it?
Well, I appreciate you giving me a couple minutes to plug my book. It's actually been finished for a while, but there were a couple of unforeseen issues that came up that were just 100% out of my control, out of a lot of people's control. And then the pandemic hit and that pushed everything back. So it sucked, because it definitely was a blow to my morale to get my book's release pushed back. But again, nothing we can do about it. That being said, I got with this publishing company, Hamilcar Publications, a couple of really nice guys in Andy Comack and Kyle Serafine, and they've been pumping out some outstanding boxing books, absolutely airtight boxing history stuff. And they offered me the opportunity to write my own book and to kind of see if I had a topic in mind. And I just happened to be reading about Oscar Bonavena and his death when they asked me that. Like, they asked like 2 days earlier or something like that. I was reading about Bonavena and his death. And for whatever reason, because I do a bunch of boxing history type of stuff, sometimes I just get a bug in my ass and like, I need to find out about something. Like, here's this fight that happened in 1912 and well, shit, now I need to download 232 articles about it. And that doesn't happen a ton, but it does happen. And it just so happened to happen about Bonavena. And then they asked me, I kind of gave them a rundown about what happened and they were like, all right, let's get this book written. So long story short, Oscar Bonavena was an Argentine heavyweight who had a very kind of troubled life, definitely drew a lot of attention to himself throughout his life, and then had a number of really big opportunities attached to big names like Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. Lost those fights, but was part of an extremely important heavyweight era and a big heavyweight era full of names that a lot of people in boxing know, like Ali and Frazier, of course. But then toward the end of his career, the last few years of his career, he went from being an active fighter who was very much a part of the heavyweight division and a very deep heavyweight division to somebody who was kind of on the fringes, in again, out again. He might fight, he might not fight. He was scheduled to fight a number of other big fighters like George Foreman and Ken Norton. Those fights never came off. And then finally, in 1976, he found himself shot at a brothel and killed. So I didn't come up with the name for the book. It's obviously a catchy title because you see that and you're like, shot at a brothel? What? Shot at a brothel? But it really did happen. It's 100% true. And there's a lot of really dark, gnarly stuff that's happening. A lot of people know the basic story about how Oscar Bonavena died. He got shot by this quote-unquote henchman. And the henchman was the employee of this brothel owner. And so that's the basic story everybody knows. But they believe that Oscar Bonavena was trying to get with the brothel owner's wife. And so that's why he had him killed. Could that have been? Maybe. But the whole point of the book is to say, is to demonstrate that there is so much more going on there that it's like you have to decide for yourself what the hell happened almost, because it's like, wow. There's so many things unfolding that I think that a lot of people are going to read the book and almost feel like I'm making it up. Like some of the things are just they fit too well. There's the puzzle pieces fit too well. They're too outlandish, but it's true.
Your first book, Patrick, or first book you've written?
It is. I've thought about writing a book for a long time, and I've written a number of pieces and articles that were like thousands and thousands of words. I think I wrote one that was like 50,000, something like that. So that's a lot, but I've never written a book before. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to it. And then, you know, as you mentioned, the publication, Hamilcar, I believe I'm saying it right.
Yeah.
The publication company, shout out to the team over there. They've been over the last few months, or actually maybe the last year or so, especially during the pandemic, they've sent us some copies of some of the titles that they've come out with during the last year or so. So we appreciate all the love we've been getting for them. And then we've had, I believe, two authors on episodes, right?
Yeah, we had Todd Schneider. He was on last year to do his book. And then I always pronounce his name wrong. Christian Gudois?
Judice.
Let's see. There you go. I don't know how I messed that up. Yeah, we had him on also. So, yeah, when they probably send a copy out, Patrick, then once I
read it. Oh, yeah, definitely.
We'll get you back on and do a review.
Well, thanks so much again for having me. It was a lot of fun talking to you guys, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Before we completely let you go ahead and plug your website, your boxing history, Twitter handle, everything you got. Obviously, your book, one more plug. Go for it before we let you go.
Yeah, just in case anybody wants to purchase my book, Shot at a Brothel, I guess you could probably look on Amazon or whatever bookstore site you're looking for Oscar Bonavena. It's probably going to be the first thing that you find. But also, I've actually been working in the recent couple days of updating my website and doing a couple things there, knucklesandgloves.com, including a podcast that I've been doing for a long time with Bryn Jonathan Butler and Aris Pina, Knuckles and Gloves podcast. So yeah, I mean, that's for the most part all I do. Every so often I'll come through with something a little tastier with some from some other place, but you know, we'll see. Otherwise, I guess if I'm probably most active on Twitter, then my handle there is Patrick M. Connor.
Sounds good. And before we completely sign off, Mike, go ahead and tell our listeners where they can find us and follow us.
So we're at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter, and be sure to join us next week. We've got the previews for someone we spoke about. Bivol is actually back. Sebastian Fundora, Lara is facing Thomas Lemena, and then obviously Derek Chisora is also fighting Joseph Parker over in the UK. So that'll be an interesting matchup with both of them having new coaches in Buddy McGurk and Andy Lee.
Absolutely, absolutely. So for our guest of the week, and Patrick M. Connor, follow him on Twitter at Patrick M. Connor. For my co-host, Michael Shepard, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This